Welcome to the podcast, Speak Your Peace. This is a podcast about Utah's history produced by the Utah Department of Culture and Community Engagement. I'm Brad Westwood, Senior Public Historian. My job is to make the very best, the most interesting, the most accurate history of Utah accessible to the widest audience. We hope if there's one place, one podcast to get your Utah history fix, this is the place. If you subscribe to this podcast, or if this is your first time listening, we hope you'll go back and listen to dozens of other prior episodes. Please also rate and review Speak Your Peace on iTunes, Google, and elsewhere. Finally, if you have an idea or know someone who should be interviewed on Speak Your Peace, please write us at askahistorian@utah.gov. My guests today are three authors of Returning Home, Danae Creative Works, from the Intermountain School. The school we are talking about is the Intermountain Indian School, closed in 1984, located in Brigham City, Utah. This book has been published by the University of Arizona Press this fall, 2021. My guests are Dr. Farina King, Associate Professor of History and an affiliate of the Department of Cherokee and Indigenous Studies at Northeastern State University in Oklahoma. Dr. Michael Taylor, Assistant Professor of English and Associate Director of the American Indian Studies Program at Brigham Young University in Provo. And finally, Dr. James Swenson, Associate Professor of Art History and the History of Photography, also from BYU Provo. Welcome and good morning, Farina, Michael, and James.
Hi.
Glad to be here.
All three of my guests today are remarkable young scholars that we want you to know more about, to read their bios and learn more about each of their respective publications and scholarship. Look up on our show notes online at community.utah.gov/speakyourpeace. With that, we have a wonderful program ahead. And thank you all. Would one of you start out our time together by reading a small essay or poem produced by the Intermountain Indian School students that has lingered in your mind?
I mean, I don't know which one Mike and James were thinking, because there's so many incredible works.
Some amazing pieces.
Even if you guess it, like, we probably have others, so we're probably good.
I know. But I mean, I thought about this on a number of occasions, and I'm sure Mike and James can add more, and definitely Mike, because he wrote a whole article about Henry Tinhorn, and he's been heavily emphasized in our piece, and the incredible journey and connections that have been made. But I just love, and this is why I included it in the introduction on page 6, was Mountain's Lament by Henry Tinhorn. And I thought it was so interesting in our work how we each kind of read something out of it, too. Because for me, when I read it, and do you want me to read it?
Yes. I want to start the interview with a piece of writing.
Okay. So this is from this, what we quote in the introduction as well, is Henry Tinhorn's, one of his poems, Mountain's Lament, where he says, where are my people? The mountains cry out. I've seen them play and live in my hands, and I felt them run the trail of my back. Before the sleepy winter came, I heard their laughter ring out and fill the valleys with joy. Now there's only the sounds of silence where once a baby had talked in meaningless sentences. Mr. Sun, you've traveled. Do you know where my people are? A drop of golden sunshine was the answer. Have you seen my people? The mountains asked the sky, but the rains came, and that was the sky's reply. Wow. That's that quote. And I think it really sticks out to me because in a lot of my work, I've thought about how Dene intellectual processes and so much that is central to Dene identity is the teachings of Sanagaibik Ehajon, which has been roughly translated as walk in beauty. But those teachings have been embodied in the landscape, and specifically the four sacred mountains, the symbolism of Zith Dien, sacred mountains. And so that poem caught my attention because it encapsulated so much that we're focusing on in this book, is home and the mountains. They are intertwined of what homelands mean to Dene on even a spiritual level, on so many levels. Mm-hmm. And Tinhorn is writing this poem while he's at Inner Mountain. And, so much that he's saying there is connecting to that. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, Mike, James, I'm sure you have things to say too.
Yeah, Farina, I'm so glad you started with Tinhorn, with Henry Tinhorn's work. In many ways, his poetry is what kind of launched this whole collaborative process together. And I could talk for a long time about Henry Tinhorn. but Brad, would you mind if I read another one, actually, to give Absolutely. A kind of a broader sampling?
Please do.
So this one is included in chapter one. It's on page 33, and it comes from Sammy Billy. And it's the title of it is White Man, Poor Man, Beggar Man, Chief. And it's this kind of a parody on a popular nursery rhyme, Tinker Tailor. Mm-hmm. And I think this one gives a really nice overview of a lot of what we're trying to do in the book, and the way that we're trying to do is emphasize and prioritize young students' voices and their experiences. But in doing so, like Farina was pointing out in Henry Tinhorn's poem, we're also helping to voice Dene knowledge and Dene ways of being. And so this one reads, I came from the Navajo reservation to the government school where they're going to educate me to the white man's golden rules. I am learning very quickly. I have learned shame, humility, and honesty. Although they call me Sam, I have an Indian name. They think they can change me by cutting my hair to meet school regulations. Will they think I'm white, quarter blood, half-breed, or Indian? Let me tell you, Mr. Teacher, when you say you'll make me white, in many years of fighting, not one Indian has turned white. While you say that I knew nothing when you brought me here to school, just another empty Indian, just America's first fool. But I can tell you stories that are dusty, dried, and old. In the shadow of their telling walks the thunder, proud and bold. Great Indian leaders of long ago who bet on Custer's soul are dead. Yet they are living with the great Geronimo. Well, you may teach me this land's history, but we taught it to you first.
Wow.
And this one's a really overtly kind of in-your-face type of poem, which wasn't always the case with this poetry or the essays that the students were writing. But I think this captures a lot of what the underlying goal of the school, the historical context of Native education at the time period, and also how frequently we saw students within their creative writing and also their visual arts, and then in their oral stories too, over and over again, be proud of their Dene identity. A lot of boarding school studies, there's one that came out about a year ago that talks about how these schools change students forever. And we're not trying to get away from that changing or the attempted erasure of Dene identity. But the students' works themselves emphasize, like Sammy Billy's does, this strong connection and maintained connection to home.
And I think that reoccurs. It's the leitmotif of your analysis. Constantly returning home. James, do you have something you'd like to share?
I do. Just as Mike was saying, yeah, and you were discussing, the leitmotif is returning home. But the one I would want to contribute just shows how much they knew about the world around them and how they were really active in the social causes of their time. So the poem I'd like to read comes from chapter 6, and it's on page 310. And this is by Frank Dottici. And in 1973, he wrote this poem, I Am. And when we were putting together the global awareness chapter, this one really stood out. And I think it's just wonderful. So I'm going to read it. I am Black Mesa. Exploit me, bleed me, forget me, to let me die. I am Alcatraz, trying to regain myself. You fear me and leave me homeless. I am Wounded Knee. All that is left of me is a dance of spirit ways. You fear it more than 1,000 armies. In the snowy silence I rest. I am freedom, wounded and struggling, hounded then, forgotten, leave me. I am freedom. I care what happens to me. You know, if you think about what's going on in 1973, mm-hmm. with the occupation of Alcatraz and the occupation of Wounded Knee and all the things that are going around and these young Navajo kids and were really just sponges. I mean, they were really anxious to see what was going on around them and relating that to themselves. So a nice little connection to be made too is, you know, you're right. They were always very focused on home and returning home, but increasingly they were very aware and very active in the world around them too.
Well, I think there's going to be some pieces we're going to read a little later on that really kind of pick up the tones of the period, the Vietnam War, the social movements and so forth. Your book is about the creative expression of young people, children really, grade schoolers to high school students, their hopes, their dreams, their homesickness, the longing, their identity, friendship, even their crushes and their first young love. And then finally, so much of it, the promise of the future. Will you talk about the very human, youthful experience that you're documenting in this book?
You know, I can start. So as the art historian on this project, I was one kind of pulling together the images. And, you know, we were limited in some ways on what we could find, but we had a lot of these great poetry books and anthologies. And when they were putting these together, they would include drawings and some were better than others, as can be imagined. But it really provided insight, as you said, into their lives. And, you know, there's one in particular that that is always stuck with me. It has two young boys and a young girl in the middle, and little hearts are kind of, you know, emitting from the two boys. And it's just so relatable to almost any 12, 13 year old and their first crushes and learning to navigate all the different worlds that any teenager or any preteen has to navigate, but compound that with obviously being away from home, being at boarding school, being at Intermountain. There's just a lot of really wonderful currents that come through beautifully in the images and the poems and the other writings that are included.
Well, I'm struck by the wonderful analysis and the candor in the book. But when I finished reading it, the thought that crossed my mind is, you know, I'm a grandfather now. I was a father. I was a young child too. And I just was, my heart was full of that sense of what I was like at 8, 9, 10, 12, teenager, 18, so forth. So it just struck me just how much this is a story about lives, young lives.
Yeah, I think that's a great point of a lot of this work is providing a platform for the intricate human lived experiences of Native Americans, because there has been so much erasure, so mm-hmm. much violence targeting Native peoples, genocide. We now are in a time with the Secretary of Interior, Deb Haaland, pushing the Federal Indian Boarding School Truth Initiative and different efforts and learning, so for some people, learning for the first time about unmarked graves and the real death and violence that children were susceptible to.
Not to mention to
targeted.
Yeah, not to mention the living trauma they endured and moved on with their lives, but the loss of life.
But then at the same time, I think something that resonates with me is how once I met a public intellectual who actually was very critical about scholars, saying scholars want to summarize everything. We need to have these nice categories and make it, you know, I don't know, fit some kind of theory maybe or something, but there's so much power in just storytelling and letting people tell their story. Mm-hmm. And when we came across all these incredible student voices that were encapsulated in poetry and art and these creative expressions, as we call it, you know, that just shows those complexities of human experience that you can't just dichotomize victim and perpetrator, colonized and colonizer. It's people living their lives. But at the same time, we also need to step back and recognize what scholars do see as these processes of settler colonialism, mm-hmm. and how to connect that.
I just want to tell our listeners that read for the understanding, but also read for that personal experience. When I picked up my copy from James, I said, "Oh, this is a thick book." And, you know, because I don't know why I thought it should be something less, but I read every poem. I looked at every drawing, and it's an experience that I hope all of my listeners will have a chance to do. Well, students who attended Intermountain Indian School, they have alumni reunions. They've gathered to remember, to capture, to reframe, even to heal, or to better understand their experience. Will one or two of you speak about that ongoing social events that are happening?
I'll start on this one. Because the reunion completely changed my frame of thinking about boarding school histories, especially this one. So Farina already knew some of the alumni, has family connections and other things like that to the community. James and I were supposed to meet Farina there at the first time we were invited to the reunion. And James and I pulled in alongside Terrence Ride, who was one of our student researchers who helped get this project off the ground. And Robert Dobson, who's the president at the time of the Alumni Association of Intermountain, he saw us pulling in and not knowing where we were going. And he looked at us and he goes, you know, he sees three white guys pulling up in a car. And he says, "Hey, are you guys lost?" And he was very friendly. They welcomed us in, and Farina came soon, and we became part of that small reunion.
Well, and to his credit, we probably looked lost.
We did look lost.
At that point, we were figuring out our own way as well.
And in a way, what we experienced there completely, I mean, I was lost, right? Like I was experiencing something I'd never been able to read about in an academic book about boarding schools, which was a community of people with their families speaking in their traditional languages, laughing, dancing, having food together. It was just a beautiful reframing of the resilience of Native youth. And others can talk about that specific reunion, but when we have a second, I'd like to also talk about broader, more individual reunions that have occurred. But I'll save that for maybe a minute later.
Well, and just on that reunion, you know, we showed up and we were there. We were warmly invited in, and you know, they were partying and talking well into the night. Well, we were already like trying to go to sleep, and the dancing went on almost all night, and. Like it was one of those things where you really got to see just how much they liked being together and how much this bond from the past continued to hold these people together and how it continues to live. It was really, it was a remarkable experience. I completely agree with Mike.
Yeah, I think, if you don't mind kind of adding to that, again, this is such a complexity because there are so many different boarding schools and many different boarding school experiences. And there are, you know, some of these Intermountain boarding school alumni who are really proud of that. And they see each other as family, the family they shape there. But then there's also others who may never go to that reunion because of the trauma and the hardship that they faced. And that's something to recognize as well. And there were conversations that I had with different people informally, casually, and there were things they shared with me that I can't share in the book mm-hmm. because they weren't comfortable to share those stories yet of some of the trauma they experienced, but they still were there to be with those who knew what they went through. And like you mentioned, it's healing. That's mm-hmm. such an important aspect. And it made me realize too, that there's a lot of need to support alumni and survivors, as they're being called more widely because of
accurately
some who didn't make it, right? And they muster so much, like they really gather, and it takes a lot of work to have these reunions. And it was very generous and kind of them to invite us. And it also took connecting with families of alumni. Lloyd Lee, Sharon Evans were really pivotal in introducing us, so we weren't entirely strangers once they knew where we were coming from, why we were there. But they always have been very gracious and welcoming to people too. There's a Navajo alumni group. There's also an intertribal alumni group of Intermountain, because that was
The last 10 years they had that opened up to all different tribes. Well, Farina, one of the things I read in your book quite frequently, resilience, just a sense of resilience in those alumni groups. But I think what I think is wonderful, and you capture in this book, is there's just not one thread. There's a whole lot of threads in this story, and some very hard to hear and understand, and some where they love each other's company, and just the fact that they're together later in their lives is important to them. And I like that. I like the way those ideas are captured. Okay, for those who know nothing about the Intermountain Indian School, will you frame up the broader facts about this school? Just all the who, what, when, where, how, please.
I mean, I don't mind giving the brief background, because that's what I was also tasked to do with the project.
That's right. You wrote the introduction, didn't you?
Yeah, as a historian. So the way I introduce Intermountain to people who never heard about it, it's first I start by telling them Intermountain Indian Boarding School opened in the 1950s after World War II, and opened specifically for Navajo students. It became one of the largest federal Indian boarding schools in American history. And why that all should be shocking to some people is that most federal Indian boarding schools closed by the early 20th century, around the 1920s, especially after the Merriam Report of 1928, where there was a federal investigation, for lack of better terms, but this inquiry by the federal government into different policies, including the boarding school policies. And there was an open criticism, quite straightforward criticism, of not only the ineffectiveness of boarding school policies, but the harm, the detriment. The detrimental aspects of it.
The Carlisle school model and so forth, right?
Yes, especially, the Carlisle model of kill the Indian and in them save the man. But for historians, they see these kind of federal government and tribal nation relations as a pendulum. At least, the well-known scholar David Wallace Adams, for his book, Education for Extinction, he's talked about this too, of where, and I see it more like waves of the U.S. federal government seeing this so-called Indian problem of Native Americans in the way to, claiming land, competing sovereignties, and the federal government seeking to basically absorb, aka assimilate terminate. It takes different names. And what happens is, while the Merriam report was this wake up call of, all right, we need to stop this federal Indian boarding school policy, we need to change directions, in the 1950s, you have a return in a new form of seeking to terminate the recognition of tribal nations and again assimilate them and absorb them. And it was Senator Arthur Watkins of Utah who proposed the idea of taking the Bushnell Military Hospital that was used in World War II and transform it into a boarding school for Navajos in particular, because Navajos, and what most people don't realize too, after World War II, there's this economic prosperity in the United States, but for many Native Americans, including Navajo Nation, they were in a desperate situation where individuals who had jobs through the wartime industry lost those jobs. You have returning veterans, and there's not the same equal opportunities of work and livelihoods on the Navajo Nation. So they're struggling to make ends meet, and then they're hit by an unprecedented historic blizzard and drought that also is hurting them. So there's this realization as the Navajo Nation is coming into formation that they actually want their children to go to schools, since they see that as a way to thrive, as a way to not only thrive, but at that point survive. Because there were families starving in that time in the late 1940s. And so they see the schools as that support. And this is where you have this convergence of Watkins being a terminationist, his idea of we need to prepare these Indians, include especially Navajos, who were seen as backward. They were. The way the federal government described them is they saw them as less civilized, the way that their language in this later half of the 20th century, they see them as needing this education, this schooling that will prepare them to be full citizens, civilized citizens of the United States. And it's shocking because you'd think, you know, the Merriam report, the eye-opening about the issues with these various policies, it's sort of like it was revitalized, a resurgence of that. But then it's a different context too, because you also have the American Indian movement gaining formation and traction, and you have all these other dynamics that people know, they are aware of that destruction, of the harm of the Carlisle model of boarding schools. So it is different, but then there's these continuities as well.
And isn't there also in the region the LDS Church placement program? And then even Watkins is kind of running in a Mormon doctrine of inescapably this big, huge community in this nation is going to somehow integrate and be, you know, sort of part of the larger culture. I mean, in a way, we have our own little regional things going on that encourage that. Instead of creating a school in the reservation, the answer was, well, we can do it better removing them and doing this. Let's talk about what years did it run? Where's the campus located? I think we haven't grounded it geographically. Who attended? The ages? Talk about what they did after school or when they left school.
Before we jump straight into that, could I also just add one layer of context to what Farina was suggesting in its connection to Watkins and termination and so on? We talk about this in the book, and maybe James or Farina could get ready to talk about the other where's and when's and who's. But this is also a time where, I mean, one of the motifs of the book, because of the students' work and what they focus on, is on land, right? And you saw that as you were reading the book, that a lot of the students' work refer back to homelands. But termination is focused on taking away indigenous lands. And we see this happening in the Navajo Nation. There's the world's largest uranium mine is being built and exploiting the Navajo Nation. at the same time that kids are being shipped away from home and trying to be terminated away from their, from the like treaty-based sovereignty of those homelands. And so I think that's something to also keep in mind. It's not just assimilation for quote-unquote civilization, but there's a there's an economic engine behind terminationism that is we need indigenous lands to continue to have a profitable or to improve the profitability of our U.S. economy. And that's happening at the same time right on the Navajo Nation as well, at, right at the time that the Intermountain Indian School is being created and students are beginning to go and attend. So I think that's important for us to recognize as well. It's not just the kind of moral and social implications of assimilation.
There's some economic issues.
But also the economic backing of why representatives like Watkins are pushing for policies like termination.
Well, and I think I love what Farina said about cycles of it's if each generation tries to do the same things, but ostensibly they're constantly removing Native Americans from lands they first thought were, that farming would not be possible or that general life would be a struggle. Okay, let's make that reservation lands. Then we discover the waters. I mean, I think of even in Uinta, the what has created most of the water for which our society and the Intermountain West thrives on. Most people who get a tap water and fill their glass full of water, they're getting water that once was part of the reservation of the Utes. So I there's a constant thing about reframing. We need these resources. Let's take it from what we had previously given to Native Americans.
Well, Brad, to your other question, so I can answer the question on location. So Intermountain was located on the eastern side of Brigham City, right below I-89 as it goes up the canyon up to Logan. And what's really great about it too is the I from Intermountain is still proudly on the hillside, so right above where the school once was. So for those traveling that direction, you can still see part of it, even though most of the buildings have been torn down after they were left into just decay for a number of decades. Utah State now has a campus, a satellite campus there in Brigham City, and that occupies part of the site. Much of the site right now is still left. There's nothing on it. There are still a few of the old barracks there that you're still visible, but for the most part, it's being repurposed and trying to figure it out. And there are markers there for those visitors who want to go that actually locate the particular buildings and some of the important things about the school, as well as a little bit about the Bushnell medical thing. And I'm the oldest of the three authors, and I'm actually the only one that probably actually remembers actually seeing students at Intermountain. When I was a young boy, we were driving up to Logan, and I remember as we were climbing up I-89, looking down, and I just remember distinctly all the buildings were there, and the streets were filled with kids my size, basically. Mm-hmm. And I remember asking my father what was going on there, and I remember him telling me there was an Indian school, and I distinctly remember there were four kids like holding arms together as they were walking down these snowy roads. And it was probably January, February. So that was a distinct memory I have. And being able to see Intermountain as it was, again, this has been early 80s, probably 2 or 3 years from being closed.
Mm, what That's a great
the,
memory.
The benefit of being the oldest member of the,
well, I attended Utah State in the mid 70s and remember very distinctly seeing the activity of the Bushnell Hospital / school in Intermountain School. Farina, please.
So James has also, I think, been really great with, I felt like James reminded us those last 10 years of the boarding school because we focused a lot on the Navajo only phase of the boarding school. As I said, it opened in the 1950s, around 1950, and was for Navajo only students until 1974, I want to say, because it was its last 10 years from 1974 to 1984, that it then was opened up to any student of a tribal nation or Alaska Native.
90 different tribal identities included in the school. So that's a interesting.
Yeah. And our book primarily focuses on the Navajo experience and context, especially because to be honest, as a Diné scholar, that was a lot of my connections and grounding in focusing on the origins of the school. And a lot of our sources and materials of student works were from Diné students. But there is so much that needs to be done still in featuring and listening to the intertribal student years, and especially in general about Indian boarding schools in the late 20th century.
Yeah,
the 70s, the 80s.
What were other schools were up and going in mid-century in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s?
There are still Indian boarding schools open today. Some that go back decades, you know, several years, such as the Sherman Indian School. It started as the Paris Institute, and then it was renamed Sherman. It's in Riverside, California.
There's about five or six of them now, isn't there, that are active, that have histories that go back way?
Yeah, Chamawa Indian School in Salem, Oregon, was also founded as one of those boarding schools following the model of the Carlisle model, and it's changed. You know, it certainly changed over the years, and it's still open to this day. There's a boarding school in my area here. I'm calling in from Tahlequah, Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma, and the Cherokee Nation runs the Sequoia Indian School that actually started as a Cherokee orphanage from the Civil War era of children left there. So there's still a lot of work to look into the 70s and 80s and more recent experiences of Indigenous boarding schools.
But there's more self-determination now.
Yes, definitely. There certainly has. And it was interesting. I mean, it was James, he can tell us this, but I love this, of in our traveling exhibit that went along with, that was really the inspiration of the book. The exhibit came before the book, and we talk about that. But James found videos of breakdancing and student breakdancing, and there's just so much more I feel like we could have talked about in terms of creative expression. We primarily focus on art in terms of, you know, painting, drawing, and poetry, but there were important dances and songwriting and other aspects of those creative expressions.
Yeah, Farina's right. I think there's so much work that needs to be done. I mean, when people hear about boarding schools, I think the image that pops into their mind is Carlisle and images of people like Tommy Torlino, who's the famous photograph of the boy who's dark-skinned, all the accoutrement of being Apache, and then being shipped to Carlisle and coming out lighter skinned.
With all the regalia.
And yeah, exactly. Coming out with a tie and short hair, and yeah, good old Tommy Torlino. I'm right. You're right, Farina. I'm wrong. And but that's the image we have. And I think as Farina is exactly right. I think understanding what goes on in the 20th century and even to the present really is another avenue that needs to be explored more fully.
Another demographic in the school that really surprised me was vets returning from Vietnam, coming and doing adult education programs at Intermountain, or English programs. I remember one of the teachers, the former teachers that we spoke to, she talked about how ridiculous it was that her administrators were telling her she needed to discipline some of her students, and her students were grown men who had just been to war. Like, and she's a recently graduated Utah State educator, and she's supposed to somehow put these Vietnam vets in their place in her classroom. And that's something that completely took me by surprise, that this boarding school was within that terminationist type model, not just for the youth, even though our book focuses a lot on kind of middle school through high school, because those are the sources that we were able to access. There's an adult demographic there as well.
Wow.
Not to mention the Native American employees, teachers, staff members. So there's a whole community, a whole community of indigenous peoples in that space that often don't get talked about when we talk about boarding schools.
And Brad, I want to add, you mentioned also the context of the Church of Jesus Christ, of Latter-day Saints, Mormonism. We actually didn't delve into that as much, but in previous research that I've done, I learned that there was a major Indian seminary program. It actually, you know, there were students, you referred to the Indian student placement program mm-hmm. of the church. Mm-hmm. Yes, there were students who had this eclectic educational experience. And that's something few people understand, is that for one Navajo student, for example, they might go to several different schools and very different kinds of schooling. Like maybe they go on placement and they go to Intermountain for 1 year. Maybe they go to an on-reservation school like the Tuba City Boarding School. And then they might go to a public school and live in a border town dormitory. So they're having this very eclectic journey and experience.
Lots
if you can imagine
up.
Your own children, you know, them changing one school. These students are not only changing schools, but going to schools in very different settings and contexts. So that's challenging. And then with the church, I think it was the seminary program being right there. It technically was not an official part of the school, but the influence of the church was certainly present. And there were students who talked about that, of how they were in a predominantly Latter-day Saint community. And that actually raised some issues of, as Mike mentioned, Native American faculty and staff, there were petitions and outcries about favoritism towards Latter-day Saint employees at their detriment, or different issues like that that came up that we didn't really have as much attention to in this book, but it's important to the conversation.
Absolutely. Well, but all three of you played a vital part in the production of this book. Would you just explain, each of you, what you contributed? And in doing this, will you also explain the organization of the book? There's a lot going on. I'd like to entice those who are listening to read this book. Please, each of you.
Do you mind if I start with kind of the genesis of it? I mean, Farina's been doing oral histories in the Navajo Nation long before we ever started doing this type of book. But this book, the larger book, and like Farina was saying, the traveling exhibit that accompanied or was our primary focus in the beginning, began with a student who we mentioned and whose work is in the appendix of the book. His name's Terrence Ride. And he reached out to me asking if I had any research that he could help out with. And I said, well, I know of this archive that's at Utah State. I would love to get into it, but I've never had a chance to. I was brand new faculty at BYU at the time. And so he started getting into the poetry, and he reached out to me again and said, Mike, this poetry is really good. Like, it's not just, there's a, prior to this book, one of the only other books I know of that features boarding school student poetry talks about it as trite pieties and school-bound platitudes is what the author calls them. And he's like, Mike, this is not trite pieties and school-bound platitudes. This is really, I mean, we know that there's some of the poetry is just school assignments and things like that. But some of it is just really hard-hitting, deep, meaningful poetry. And so we set it out as a goal to somehow get this poetry back to the community. And so we reached out to Farina and said, Farina, is this something you think members of the Navajo Nation would be interested in seeing back in their hands somehow? And she said, absolutely. And this needs to be a much bigger project than what you and Terrence are doing. And so that's when Farina and I started talking, and then we brought James in because of the all of the creative visual art that we saw in the archives as well. And that's kind of how the responsibilities have carried through the entire project. I've focused on the poetry and writing. James has worked primarily on the curation of materials, designing the exhibit that we traveled to different locations in and around the Navajo Nation. And then Farina's focused on the oral history and a lot of the kind of historical methodological context of the book.
Hmm. Anything more, friends? That was a good description.
Yeah, I think that gives a good overview. So when I was brought on, I was excited just because I started to get into it, but then once I discovered that Alan Hauser was the art teacher at Intermountain for the first 10 years from 1951 to 1961, that got me even more excited. You know, if Alan Hauser is one of the most important artists of the 20th century, let alone a Native American artist, and to have him there in Brigham City and teaching a generation of young DNA students, I thought was really exciting. And so there really wasn't much of a hook. I think I was pretty much like loved the project from the start. And with the help of two students, Megan Anderson and Melanie Allred, we curated an exhibition that started at BYU and then went down to the Gallup Cultural Center, where it was there for a few months. And then the biggest, probably most important, was when we moved this traveling exhibition to the Navajo Museum, Navajo Nation Museum, there in Window Rock. And for that, we brought down, Utah State is in the possession right now of two enormous murals that they were able to preserve from the original buildings. And so we were able to bring those down. And if, you know, we always talk about returning home, I mean, that's a motif that obviously comes up a lot in this discussion. But this was one of the primary opportunities to really bring it back home to the DNA and to bring it back to the Navajo Nation. So it was there for a few months. And after that, COVID hit, and luckily it was at the Klein Library at NAU at Northern Arizona University. And then it came back to my office, and we're really excited that it's going to be shown in Logan as the last stop. So
when is that?
It'll be at the Merrill Kaiser Library at Utah State University beginning in January of 2022. It will be there through April. So if people want to see the exhibition, there's still one more opportunity to see it.
Wonderful.
And we have to give James credit as the U-Haul driver to all of these locations.
I put on a lot of miles on a few U-Hauls here and there. And I had to get the big one because that's how big these murals were. And if you see these murals on the wall, just so you know, they're very heavy, especially there's one that's particularly heavy. So, but it was really wonderful being able to bring those home, and hopefully at some point we can bring them home in a more meaningful, permanent way.
Well, one thing I was impressed.
I'm so grateful to have met James through this project and to get to work more with Mike. Mike and I, we met at a Native American Indigenous Studies Association conference. So he knew about my work in focusing on Diné educational experiences in my first book, The Earth Memory Compass, which looks at Diné schooling experiences in the 20th century. And a lot of different people had come up to me and told me, Intermountain, have you looked into Intermountain? You know, they kept asking. So when Mike brought it up, it certainly rang a bell of, okay, this does need to be addressed. You know, this needs some major projects, and there's a lot here to unpack or to connect with. And so for me, I think it is a lot about, of course, learning how important education is of teaching everyone the significance of Native American experiences, because I mean, here we are, November passed recently, and most of the people, what they learn about Native Americans is in Thanksgiving myth, maybe packed into Native American Heritage Month, but it's still a lot of misinformation, a lot of distortions about Native Americans. And so there's that angle of it, of just educating people. But then at the heart of it, for me, And I think it really comes out with the organization of the book and how we emphasized being having translations and Deneh Bazad, working with Rena Dunn, a Deneh language instructor, is the community, and writing this for Intermountain alumni, families, and Navajo Nation in many ways, and then also extending to Native American alumni from many different tribal nations and places. Because when we did the traveling exhibit, we saw that as returning home, bringing and making accessible.
It wasn't just a gaze
arts
in.
And poetry that some of these students haven't been able to access themselves after they graduated and moved on, or their families haven't been able to really see that. And I'll remember meeting Archie Washburn at one of the Deneh Intermountain reunions, and how he said, one of these days, my family will know that I'm a poet, you know, that I'm a writer. And even though he didn't professionally become, you know, a famous poet that everybody knows, like William Shakespeare or something, that was important for him.
It brought it home. And all this came home to all of these authors and their families and their communities. I read that also. That seemed to be very strong. It wasn't just gazing in like some sort of 20th century anthropologist. It seemed to have been for and by the community, and you're speaking to that. I think that's a wonderful part of your book.
Yeah, and they asked us to write a book. The alumni did, a number of them, because initially it wasn't a concrete decision that we would write a book. We worked on an interdisciplinary grant through the Charles Redd Center for Western Studies. So they have been a major sponsor of this project, getting it off the ground, and our respective universities, Brigham Young University and Northeastern State University. And then of course, all the community, all the partners at Navajo Nation Museum, you know, the director there and incredible staff there, so many different people who made this possible. But it was the community, alumni themselves, who asked us, are you going to write a book? We want something to give to our children, to our grandchildren, that is, you know, tangible.
Wow.
Let me speak to that for just a second, because part of the organization of the book, so as you announced, Brad, we worked with the University of Arizona Press, and they were absolutely fantastic in working with them. But there was a lot of back and forth kind of, so what is this book exactly? Is it an academic book? Is it more public history? And we said, well, it's both. We're writing it for the community, but we hope that the academy, that the universities, will also see this as a potential model for how to do community-based collaborative research. And so, as you notice in the book, we don't really talk about methodologies and theory and any of that until the very end of the book. And we did that on purpose. We wanted it to be accessible to the community, that it's telling their story. And like Farina was saying, there's a huge component of just making sure we get it back in the form of a book that's manageable for them. And that they can have in their own hands, because a number of these students and their families especially never got to see the students' poetry. So Henry Tinhorn's sister, for example, when I first met her, he was never home while she was growing up. And then he went to Vietnam right after Intermountain
and passed away
while he was in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And so when I just brought back printed copies of his poems that we found in the archives. And she had this memory of him in the summertime when he'd come home from school, he'd sit underneath a kerosene lamp and just scribble poetry into his notebook. Mm. But she'd never really seen the published poems that he had done as a student. I just got a Facebook message yesterday, actually, because Farina and I have been trying to send books out to all the people that we've met and talked to and so on. And one of them just messaged me saying, thank you so much. You don't know how much it means to us. A part of him is still with us now and makes us happy.
So they're reclaiming their work as individuals, as families, and as the community. I mean, so there is a certain strengthening of identity through this work.
Could I also share something I want to be able to say too, of how these communities live on? Like, this is living history. And for example, the oral histories for me were, it's interesting because we included quotes and stories from different students, but it wasn't necessarily, you know, the oral histories that we were centered on or focused on. Those often were helping to contextualize or really connect voices there. But I did an oral history with Rena Dixon, and it opened my eyes to how this is living history, the connection between past, present, and even future. Because I went to her house, and Rena Dixon was a student at Intermountain who took a class with Alan Hauser, and James mentioned that. And Rena had these beautiful paintings on her walls, and I don't think that she painted them while she was at the school, but I asked her about her paintings, and she didn't become a professional painter. She didn't identify as that, but her paintings were just gorgeous, just very striking to me. And there was one of the wagon going off to the distance. And I find it really interesting that wagon for people, they always think pioneer, especially in Utah. You know, I bet that's what people will think automatically. But there were various images in the artworks you'll see in the book that have wagon, and it's appropriated by Navajos. It's important. The wagon became important symbol of Navajo mobility and motion and family even. That's how Navajos went and visited each other and got around, went to ceremony. And this is depicted in the images, and people it's making them rethink, you know, how they see these things. And she painted this wagon and said, told me a story of how her grandparents or her uncle, I believe, but relatives would drop her off to be sent to boarding school. And she'd see them right away on the wagon. And that was her painting.
Last so memory.
Even though she didn't, even though she didn't paint it while she necessarily was at the boarding school, it was that memory etched into the painting. And she relayed to me, she brought up how Alan Hauser had an influence on her of showing her you can be proud of being Native and do Native arts. Like, through the arts, your Native identity can continue. You know, it can be a way it can thrive, was basically what she expressed to me, which was really powerful.
Wow.
So can I just add something? So if you want to see that painting that Freena just mentioned, that's on page 129. And one more thing about the organization of the book. So just back to your question. So Mike wrote the chapter on the poetry and the literature. Freena was mentioned to the introduction, which was really great coming out of all of her work with oral histories. I wrote the chapter on the visual arts program there. And then as we started to see the art and poetry and the creative expressions themes, certain themes started to pop up. So that's the remaining chapters of the text, which looks at sacred lands, family, global awareness, and school. So that's how the rest of the book is organized. But you'll see that there are certain poems and things that allude to one. And I mean, we tried to do our best, but those are the primary themes that we saw popping up.
Wonderful. You've been listening to the podcast Speak Your Piece, where writers, historians, and contributors to Utah history share their insights and discoveries. My guests today have been Farina King, Michael Taylor, and James Swenson, who will be with me for the second half of this episode as we discuss the history of the Intermountain Indian School, but even more so the creative works, the art, the poetry, the personal writings created by Diné or Navajo students attending the school from 1950 into the mid-1970s. This Bureau of Indian Affairs school was open from 1950 to 1984. King, Taylor, and Swenson's study focuses, however, as they mentioned, during the first 20 years when the student body was entirely from the Navajo Nation, and from that being around Utah, Arizona, and New Mexico. We hope you'll stay with us for the second half of Speak Your Piece. Welcome back to Speak Your Piece. Let's read some student work. Would one of you please read the one on page 133, Lily White's poem, He Stands With Dreams?
Sure, I can read that. He Stands with Dreams by Lily White. He stands looking over the silent desert. Before him stands the beautiful mesa, dressed in the rich, bright colors of nature. He looks beyond the mesa to the future. The dreams that he's hoping for someday will come true. The day will come when we will be one people, associate together like one happy family, but will not forget what our ancestors have gone through. We will keep our cultural ties and live with others like real Americans.
Wonderful. Could one of you read Anderson Benali's poem, I Am an American? And will you give us some national context to this poem?
Yeah, I can go ahead and read that one. So the national context is Vietnam War. And as we kind of spoke to before, Intermountain, as well as other boarding schools, were often pipelines to military service. And a number of students at Intermountain served in the Vietnam War, came back to Intermountain after the Vietnam War. So this is a very present reality for the students' works that are here in the book. But Anderson Benali's I Am an American reads, I'm an American, tired of war, fighting for our fellow men, in a country afar to abolish tyranny, to enjoy, to be free. Who is weary across the sea, in a war that may never end, like a lion fighting to win against time?
Wonderful, thank you. Next, could one of you read The Great Spirit by Ruby, is it Peschlosky? This poem was written in 1970, and it speaks of a much long-standing group of Proud Boys.
Yeah, I can read this one. Again, relates to what Mike was mentioning about the Vietnam War and all the boys that we're going to have to serve. Great Spirit, where have all our young warriors gone? Why are the war drums beating again, motioning our young men to come and fight an unknown battle, to fight in a land so strange to us? Oh, Great Spirit, we are sad. We are weary from heartaches. We have waited many moons for the return of our Proud Boys, who stand so tall and proud of his country and eager to serve for their great country. We have waited with hope and great patience. Only few have returned. Well, I guess they will never return, for they have done what their country expects them to do. Great Spirit, we are proud of our young warriors.
Wow, thank you. Next, I'd like to ask if one of you would read Brother Albert by Cleo Brown, written in the early 1970s, and that's page 325.
Okay, yeah, I can do that. 325. Brother Albert, that boy over there with the tan skin, black hair, trusting eyes. Tell them all that I am brave. Tell them that I want to go. Tell them. He told me he was scared, just a little, but he said, don't tell. That boy over there with the tan skin, black hair, trusting eyes. We have to fool mom and dad and the little kids, anyone else too. That boy in Vietnam, the statistic, is my brother Albert. Cleo Brown. I think also when you look at this poem, it's different because it has two columns, the way that it was written and organized. And maybe that's something Mike and James might want to add to was actually the University of Arizona Press. They had different questions about the formatting because we tried to preserve, to keep the formatting that the students wrote in. And that could raise some confusion with, you know, the editing and whatnot. But we wanted that to stay, you know, the way that the students wrote out these poems. So with this one, it can raise that question of, do you read, you know, across the row or down the column? It was written a little different there. Mm. I don't know if Mike has something he wants to add to that, because he was especially attuned to that.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and just add that I was grateful that they allowed us to preserve the formatting, because whether it's difficult to look back and say, okay, did the poet choose to do this or was this the editor's? Because a lot of these were in the student publications, whether that's the student newspaper or they had literary magazines or art magazines. And those were all student produced. So they have a teacher or staff that was kind of the advisor of the different student publications. But there was a team of students that put together these journals. And so preserving the formatting also preserves the creativity of the editorial process that a number of the students are doing alongside that of the poet.
That's wonderful. Let's read one more. My House Mother by Maureen Anthony, written in 1969, page 257.
I'm glad you chose this one, Brad. I was just rereading it. And this sheds light on one of the realities that Farina spoke to already, which was kind of that disparity of what staff positions Native employees had. So a lot of Native American employees that were employed at Intermountain were house mothers, meaning those that oversaw the dormitories that the students were living in. And I think that's reflected here, the type of relationships that students created with these kind of surrogate Native mother figures. So 3 o'clock bustle on Intermountain sidewalk. Students striding purposefully with armfuls of books. Boys and girls drag reluctantly past the popcorn odor of the campus shop. The late afternoon sun lights the windows and glares of light flash. I see my proud reflection in the panes, a small girl. I stare at my reflection as I walk behind Mary. How proud, how pretty, how. And there she was, the young lady standing in the dusky shadows of a doorway, and her eyes watery, pale, staring senselessly, like the eyes of an animal killed long ago. I look at my house mother, and the dead soul mirrored in her staring, watery eyes impelled me. I step closer, slowly, then stand before her looking, and slowly, so slowly, I thank her. And then her eyes met mine, and I searched them, seeing the faint flicker of understanding, and rose slowly, so slowly, and down again, and our eyes knew, and together we understood that we both care.
Wonderful, thank you. Well, the three of you placed these pieces read, and the hundreds of others published pieces in this book in the context of Indigenous literature. Does it, and if so, where does it fit into this gathering, this emerging literary canon? Terrence Ride, in the appendix, describes this work as, quote, important literary and cultural artifacts because they push readers and viewers to ask the broader questions. Tell us more, please.
So I can speak to this one. When we talk about literary or Native American literary history, we often talk about early, like 1800s to early 1900s, and autobiographies or oral histories, right? And that's the only, if we look at American anthologies, we see very few Native texts that are actually produced by Native Americans. It's by ethnologists, anthropologists, and so on. And then we see this huge gap until about the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, when we have authors like Leslie Marmon Silko and N. Scott Momaday beginning to get national recognition. We have very few, if any, throughout the whole modernist period of the early 1900s into the 1930s or so. And then Intermountain comes along in 1950, so right before this, what's called the Native American Renaissance. A lot of literary scholars will talk about that time period of the 1960s onward as the Native American Literary Renaissance. And so these poems are being produced and the writings are being produced right at the cusp of what becomes known nationally as the literary renaissance of Native Americans. And it's interesting that these poets, Henry Tinhorn, for example, he dies before any of his poems hit the public, right? He self-publishes at Intermountain. He's going to school at the same time that some of the first poet laureates of the Navajo Nation are, like, he's publishing his own work before they even start publishing their work. So I was really excited to see that our work has actually helped to fill in a gap of Navajo, like, recognized Diné literary histories. Just recently, the University of Arizona Press also released what's called the Diné Reader, or the, it's a literary anthology of Navajo literature. And they talk about, just briefly, Intermountain as being a space that continued literary traditions of the Navajo Nation. And until this research, that wasn't recognized as a reality, as something that continued the literary history, continued traditions, continued the innovation of literary creative thought. And so oftentimes when we talk about any of the literature that happened from early 1900s until the 1960s, it's only contextual. Like, this is important literature because it gives us a lens into the context. And what Terrence Wright's pointing at here, and as you mentioned in his piece in the appendix, is that we need to move beyond only contextual importance. Like, so yes, this poetry, these works, they give us a window, an unprecedented window into boarding school life, but they also contribute to the ongoing growth of Diné literary realities. So whether that's the aesthetic choices, the structural choices, like Farina's talking about, or that opening poem that Farina started with The Mountain's Lament, of continuing a creative, expressive tradition of telling stories of Navajo creation and sharing land-based indigenous knowledge. That's all embedded within this poetry that become trademarks of what is now known as really the beginning of Native American aesthetic recognition within the literary arts.
So, for me, I felt that I was reading something unique and full of interest and new scholarship, and it, not to mention what it shares and brings back to the community as a whole. There are hard truths, difficult history that needs to be understood and acknowledged. However, before we speak about this, will you speak about how the Intermountain student, how they emotionally had this emotional adaptation, how they developed and expressed resilience? Something through this book makes very clear that even though something was, they were submitted to something really difficult, they were organizing their lives away from home in such a way that they retained their identity. There was this sense of language and culture. Talk about that, this theme throughout the book.
Could I say that in terms of resilience, I think something we were also trying to emphasize was an idea shared by different scholars like Jeffrey Korntassel about everyday acts of resurgence. And I think a part of that is innovation and creativity and how dynamic these students are, that I know the comments James shared earlier and Mike, it all relates to as well, of people trying to navigate their lives, drawing from what they inherit, what they know from their land, from their family, from their community, but being placed into situations. I mean, in a lot of the oral histories, so many of the students would talk about how disorienting it was. Like, they were going to this school in the mountain. That's how they said it in Navajo, a school in the mountain, you know, and what does that mean, where they're in this place so far from home? They're trying to grow up. They're trying to learn, do the best that they can, and face difficulties like anyone does. And then in the broader dynamics that Mike, I'm glad he brought up earlier too, of settler colonialism, the extraction, the effort, why, you know, getting to the questions as to why were Native youth especially targeted to detach them from their homelands? And even the questions that we still have open of those murals, for example, and these arts, how can they be accessible to the communities that they belong to when they were also made in this space and this kind of, for lack of better words, right, the in-between space of students going away from home, making something new? Do they leave it there? Do they bring it back home? How does it connect? So I wanted to say that. Mm-hmm. And maybe I know we've talked a lot about the literature, but on the cover is Robert Chee's painting. And I'd love to hear James talk about Robert Chee in these kind of dynamics too, you know, that he was through his art creating something new, but also tying into some aspects of Diné culture and identity that are continuities and intergenerational, but then it's always that balance, right? Of a new generation forging themselves, but then how they're connected to their family and their ancestors as well.
You know, I think one of the things is, as you both were just speaking, that this notion of survivance that is so important, and resilience, like how do you know, survive? How it's more than survive, but flourish in that survival. And I think we can't underestimate the power of expression to help anybody. And I think through poetry, through writing, through the visual arts, these young students had a venue, had a vehicle through which they could express themselves. And, you know, granted, I'm sure some of them were, not able to express maybe themselves fully in certain classes or in certain contexts, but from the poems and from the work that the artwork that survives, you can see an opportunity for them to express who they are, what they long for, what they miss, their hopes and everything. I mean, even just that poem that Mike just read, I find myself going back to these poems, and even if I read them once before, I get something new from them every time. I mean, there's just such a depth of expression there that really speaks to the power of being able to express you who you are through these tried and tested mediums. Freen actually brings up a good example in her introduction, an artist that she knows well named Jesse Holiday, who said that art pulled me out, that when everything was like just, you know, against these kids, that it was the arts. And that could have been, you know, several different forms of expression here, but that's what made resistance, resilience, survival, survivance, right? All these words that we use that made that possible. And just speaking briefly to Robert Chee, that was one of the great, just wonderful parts about the discovery process, in that we have this young student named Robert Chee who comes from St. Michael's, just outside of Window Rock, who comes to Intermountain in the 1950s, studies with Alan Hauser. And, you know, in the yearbook, and you can actually go back and see the old yearbooks, it often listed, especially for the first few decades, the occupation that these students were studying. And typically they were rather, utilitarian, housekeeper, or, you know, mechanic or painter. But Robert Chee was listed as artist. And I think there was something really powerful in that. He'd seen the example of Alan Hauser. Alan Hauser was his teacher who taught him, you know, how to truly express who he was and who his people were. And you see that. And it became a way for him not just to express himself, but to make a living, which was unfortunately cut short. He dies of pneumonia in 1971. And yet there are these stories. I mean, just like we've been able to bring out and bring to the fore people like Archie Washburn and Tinhorn, who, again, we obviously can't speak enough about, but there's a number of these artists, visual artists, who are still, you know, like Robert Chee, that we need to find, we need to bring out, and we need to have their families know just how good these young students were.
Let's make sure we have a few pieces of art on the show notes for those who want to, not to mention also want to buy the book.
Yeah, we can get you some of that. I'll be happy to send that to you.
So 3 weeks ago, while attending the Utah Division of Indian Affairs powwow, I spoke to Leo Platero, who was one of the last Native American art teachers at Intermountain before it closed. And he recounted what was the same and what was different regarding his own BIA schooling experience some 20 years earlier in New Mexico. And as an art teacher 30 years later at Intermountain, as I understand it, Intermountain was one of the few schools that continued, and we have a number of them still open today. But in the 1950s, Leo was punished for speaking his native language. He received an identifying number for his person, for his uniforms, for his personal effects. He described marching daily following a very strict military regimen. Maybe now is the time to speak about what was the evolving ideologies, the policies, and the wanted outcomes regarding these schools. Let's talk about some difficult history for a few minutes.
Yeah, and that's Leo Platero, who James actually was able to talk to and work with a bit. So that'd be great to hear a bit about that. But I think about these hard truths are, even what you mentioned there, Leo is someone living today, like my own father. This is why I started studying Indian boarding school experiences, is because almost all my Diné relatives were sent to boarding schools. And even if they were dropped off by their own parents, why did their parents feel that they needed to do that? Why would my grandparents drop off my dad when he was 5 years old and he didn't speak any English, and take him to a school where they punished him for speaking Navajo? And it's really shocking. And then what I found out even recently is that these schools, I don't know which school Leo Platero went to that he was telling you about, but there were students who had very similar experiences to Leo Platero in boarding schools in Navajo Nation, within our sacred mountains, within our homelands. And that is so infuriating. Mm-hmm. That, can you imagine it, that kind of intrusion, that kind of invasion of this foreign school on your own land, indoctrinating your own children, your future, that their language means nothing, that it's useless? And it's very sensitive to me because I do not speak Diné Bezaad. It was not my first language. And though my father hesitates to say it explicitly, I have learned what he's gone through more and more, and I'm still learning, because these are painful for the survivors, for the individuals who went through, to talk about it. Because again, they are not victims. They're not just victims, right? They don't want to be remembered that way either. They have gone through so much, and they are often beautiful, you know, human beings, mm-hmm. all of them, mm-hmm. in their own way. And I think, you know, it makes it really complicated to share such trauma. Even my own father, the kinds of abuse that he faced, not just from the school personnel, but even from bullies, other students, and the kind of lateral violence that could happen too, that we don't know how to even talk about, how to address that. So it is just so shocking that this is my own father. These are my cousins who went through some of these experiences. And I think really eye-opening that this was happening even in Navajo Nation. And why? How could this happen? And that we're in a context that the Navajo Nation is still fighting for sovereignty, for self-determination over the schools for their own communities and their children and what's taught there. I want to emphasize that because there are lawsuits, there are struggles still going since the forced removals of Navajos on the Long Walk, a death march to a concentration camp, Fort Sumner, Ahuelte, in the mid 19th century. These are interconnected.
There's and still all these different struggle. Histories connected. Thank you. Friends, any other comments?
I'll go ahead and just add, early on, when our goal here was not to try to sugarcoat any of the hard histories. Sometimes when we talk about boarding schools and we talk about like two young Native students falling in love, that sometimes that gets read as skipping over the hard parts. And that's not our goal at all with this book. Our goal is to, as we talked about earlier, to emphasize the absolute beautifully complex humanity, the adaptive ability, the continuance of indigenous knowledge, despite the hard realities, and sometimes because of the hard realities. Mm-hmm. So just as a brief example, and without having to go into too much detail, when I reached out the very first time to Henry Tinhorn's sister and said, I found his poetry in an archive. Would you be interested in it? She said, yes. But when we met, she explained to me that she had spent most of the morning weeping to her husband and her husband trying to convince her to go because she didn't want to have to relive her own boarding school experiences and the realization that she is separated from her older brother for his entire, like the majority of her life.
She missed that personal summers. She missed that otherwise familial interaction with a brother.
She did. And like Farina was saying, they lost a father at a very young age because of uranium induced disease. That's all interconnected as well with this larger project. And, she ended up sharing some of her own boarding school stories with me. She went to a school on the Navajo Nation and suffered some of those things that Farina's talking about. And then she expressed how healing it was to read her brother's poetry, to see what he was able to create despite. And she explained that he was one who suffered from depression quite heavily, who contemplated suicide often, who knew that he wouldn't live to an old age. And this is one of the hard realities that even at these reunions, we'll hear fun stories. We'll hear stories about the rodeos. We'll hear stories about swimming and the homecoming dances and all these things. And we'll hear alumni talk about all these positive things that happened. But as Farina suggested, in private, we hear about the hard realities too. Mm-hmm. And it brings it all to life that these are living hard realities. It's not passed down intergenerational trauma only. These are our fellow community members here in Utah that are carrying these histories and these embodied individual experiences with them.
Well, when I think of
can I just add one more thing? So when Leo Platero returned to boarding school to teach as an instructor at Intermountain, he would have found a very different boarding school than the one he encountered in the 1950s. But as my colleagues have mentioned, and they're exactly right, it doesn't mean that it was free from mental abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse. I mean, those things were still a part of this boarding school experience.
Yeah.
Different from the 1950s, no question, but still a part of the larger experience.
Well, first I want to express, Farina, thank you for sharing those personal feelings. And I think as three wonderful young scholars, I commend you for the way you've approached the subject, the way you've included all this material. I think listeners, you can understand and become much more acquainted with a part of Utah's and Western United States story that needs to be told. I think altogether there are 60,000 Native Americans that live on the Wasatch Front, not to mention those that live in the various sovereign nations or reservations. It's a big part of the history of Utah, and it's essential that I commend you listeners to pick up a copy of this book. As we close, could all three of you interact with me regarding contemporary issues today? Let's just talk about Native American identity, representation, displacement, land rights, indigenous sovereignty, the ambiguity of cultural boundaries. Let's just frame up some things for our readers or listeners as we close.
I can start with this one. Farina spoke to this already, but with the recent announcement of the federal investigation that's now ongoing with boarding schools, that all came out because of the mass graves and unmarked graves found in some of the Canadian First Nations residential schools. And then the recognition that we have those here in Utah too, right? There's an open investigation right now with one of the Paiute schools. There were also students who died at Intermountain, and we haven't looked into that specifically as to where their bodies ended up. But all of this is interconnected to displacement, land rights, cultural identity. Like, you read the manuals of Intermountain about what morals BIA administrators assumed young Dene peoples didn't have, or what jobs they thought they were preparing them for, what identities they were hoping to shape. The hard part of doing Indigenous history is how repetitious the strategies of discrediting Indigenous knowledge are. We talked about this with the ideas of termination and boarding schools coming as just another strategy to get rid of tribal status, to get rid of culture, to get rid of all claims to land. And it happens again and again and again and again. And today we're seeing similar things happening when it comes to when we look at pipelines or mining here in Utah. Let's localize it to Bears Ears, for example. We discredit Indigenous knowledge, Indigenous geographies, Indigenous connections to land, all in the name of public access to that land. But then that public access quickly becomes private access to extractive industries that are all claimed then as public good because they create jobs. And that's not to invalidate any of those arguments, but it's to help us recognize that the same strategies used to enable boarding school type policies are the same public strategies being used to convince the public to discredit Indigenous people's humanity today and their connection to their homelands and their connections to one another. I'll leave it at that, but just to
thank you, Michael.
It's hard, especially when you work with students who have never heard about the history or the present realities, to have them all of a sudden have this aha moment of, wait a second, this is still the same old story. It's still going on in our backyard. So.
Any other comments, friends?
Just a couple of things. My colleagues can speak more to this with much more power and much more experience than I can. But I think one of the things that has been a real benefit of this project for me is that every time I meet some of a Navajo, and I meet more of them now, right, that I'm involved in, every one of them had connections to this particular boarding school. Every one of them in some form, whether it was an uncle, a brother, they themselves went to Intermountain. There were very few that don't have some sort of personal connection. And many of those with this personal connections are still here, right? They are living in the cities, they are living and everywhere. And as Mike said, I think we need to acknowledge that this change has come about over time in history. We need to understand that history. We need to do a better job of recognizing what has happened, and we need to make amends for some of these things that have taken place. And even if that means just seeing the world around us a little bit, being a little bit more open, mm-hmm. and seeing those who, are everywhere, right? And that, then that is going to be a huge benefit. And I think one thing, as I said earlier, I keep going back. Every time I pick up the book, I find something new. I find something that resonates more deeply with me. And I think especially right now, we could all do a better job of being able to see each other in a more personal and a deeper, more emotive way.
Thank you.
Could I also add something? This project, I began the introduction with and actually tied the conclusion part with, James mentioned, was my friend Jesse Holiday, who is more than a friend. For Dene, we are, we're family. You know, we are very close and tight knit. Even, you know, the clan relations we have, or just being a part of a tribal nation now that is dynamic, it's changing over time, but shared stories or just memories and different aspects. So Jesse, he's like Shaje Yaje, he's like my little father. And my family came really close to him, and he's from the Holiday family, who are a prominent Dene family in Monument Valley area and Ojeto areas. And Jesse shared with me when I talked to him about his memories of going to Intermountain, and I'd see his art, and that he became an artist who eventually returned home. You know, he had all these crazy stories of having to go to boarding school because his parents were threatened, of being jailed, and all these hard experiences that James quoted well of the art was a part of pulling him through it. And he comes home as a professional, becomes an art teacher, teaching the arts to children. And Mike and I had a powerful experience of bringing students from our respective universities to Sabi in this guy elementary school, the elementary school in Monument Valley, and bringing Jesse to meet with them. And it was such a powerful moment for me of this is why this matters. And I think especially in the context of this pandemic of COVID-19 and the 21st century, is Navajo Nation has been one of the hardest hit communities in the world. And I was worried, will Jesse make it? Will whoever make it, the people I've met and talked to, are they alive? You know, and how this pandemic has been another moment for people to pause and address the question, why are some communities more susceptible than others? Why is there this disparity? And that it didn't come from a vacuum. It didn't come from nowhere. That this is tied to the histories. This is these ongoing dynamics and struggles. And even just thinking of Jesse, I had a conversation about, you know, how there was a scarcity in lockdowns on Navajo Nation because the Navajo Nation did respond promptly and did have been doing everything they can, including the community, that resiliency again, the survivance of doing what they can to sustain life, to continue. And my father even told me, he said, Jesse doesn't have a refrigerator. He doesn't have a refrigerator. because people thought, all right, with these lockdowns, they can save, have their food storage, all these things. And that shook me. That's something I recently learned, you know, with the pandemic and talking to Jesse throughout this project and the work. He's been an important lens for me and a connection for me with this story, these stories of Intermountain Indian School. And, you know, what can we do? You know, it's many factors, many different things, but I think James really hit it there of it's about visibility. And when you know, and when you see, and you unerase, because there has been, as we said, that intent erasure, it's intentional many times to not know, because when you don't know, you can say you're ignorant and just be oblivious to these issues and inequalities and even perpetual violence and have your hands free. But when you do know, you're going to learn how to listen, which I know Terrence Ride, who worked with Mike, he emphasized how he's learned that a lot from Mike. And that's what I appreciated working with James and Mike, is we are learning how to listen and not just barge in somewhere and say, here's the solutions, here's the answers, but it will come through these relationships and seeing and listening and building that relationship of reciprocity with communities. And it's hard. It's still even hard to just get books to as many of the alumni as we can. Like, these are realities that our institutions don't have that kind of funding. They don't take these things into account. So we are also really trying to break through some barriers, even in our own profession and structures and such, trying to change things, navigate things the best we can. But that's something I wanted to share. And I'm really so thankful for the students and their families and people who made this work possible, of sharing their stories. And why I do this is I want my children to know and remember these things, so we can learn to listen and do something to have a better future for everyone.
Wonderful. Thank you. I think of our purpose for Speak Your Peace, and one of them is to make history available for the future and to understand how to solve and resolve. And I think the comments about listening are so essential. Those who pick up Returning Home will gain the insights that Farina is speaking of. Please remember to rate and review Speak Your Peace on Apple, Google Podcasts, wherever you find it, wherever you listen. Would you please rate us? This podcast was recorded and engineered at the Studio Underground here in Salt Lake City. I thank my sound engineer and post-production editor, Connor Sorensen, from Studio Underground. I also express my special thanks to Spencer Stokes, president of Stokes Strategies, who owns Studio Underground. Speak Your Peace is a podcast where writers, historians, archaeologists, curators, anyone who has a story to tell, we want to have those insights and discoveries expressed here. If there's one place, one podcast to get your Utah history fix, I hope this is the place. Thanks to you, Farina King, Michael Taylor, and James Swenson, for joining me today. And thanks to all of those who are listening. I hope that you will once again tune in to the next episode of Speak Your Peace.